Welcome to Leaders Talk with Leo, where we discuss with industry, thought, and mental health leaders from around the world. And of course, we discuss topics such as initiatives, philosophies, strategies of some of the top leadership practices occurring today. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and always don't hesitate to reach out.
Hello, everyone. I am with Miss Anita Raymond Gray, who is a very good friend, but also has someone that she's asked someone that can really share a lot of insights between having almost five master's degrees, I think, at this point. I mean, it's like Pokemon. You got to catch them all at this point. and then, of course, you know, she's really committed towards sharing knowledge. She's been an instructor, an educator. She's launched her own fashion line. And she's also, of course, I think also infused the well-being of the environment into her projects with fashion as well, and sustainability, of course. And I think that, you know, we're really honored to have you with us today live on Leaders Talk. And I'd like to kick off by kind of just getting a start with, you recently had a discussion on TED Talks. And I would like to see, you know, what was that about? Were you nervous? What was the subject that you discussed? If you can, you know, share with us some of what happened.
Thank you so much. Hello. Thank you for the introduction and very kind words. Every time you say something about myself, it feels like I'm learning more about myself. As for the TED, it was my second TED out of 10, as I tell people, because I believe there are so many topics to be covered, actually, in the educational space. I would lie if I would say that I wasn't nervous. And I think the nervousness kicks in like 10 minutes before you go on the stage, and you can be behind the curtains, you know, do all sorts of stuff, like stand as a star, jump, it's like... fuel yourself with like positive hormones and energy. But then once your mouth start becoming dry, like I think I consumed like two bottles of water and it would just go down. And then I realized like, what's my biggest fear here? So I started talking to myself, because once you're out there in the lime spots, right? And usually for some reason, twice in my life, you can't see anybody's faces. You know, there are people, you feel the energy. And that was like, I think it was the cinema space. So it's like over around 400 people. I decided to go this way around it. It's like my biggest fear was that I would skip a line, you know, forget something, and then I wouldn't deliver it the way I would want to, and I wouldn't make as big as an impact. So it's like too much of an expectation on my end of myself. And I started approaching it with love and care, self-care. I decided if I skip a line, nobody even knows that that line existed. If I forget something, it's like nobody saw my... A few people did editing for me. They would kind of like go through the text. And I was there for the goodwill of delivering the information on creativity and educational processes and creativity as the language for everybody to discover in order to heal. So my intentions were good. It was based on my experience and work with, like, I think I worked and coached like in total students and business people altogether around 3,000 people in different groups and at different times. So I just realized I'm not going there to harm anybody. So whatever comes is the best way, is the best way I could deliver. And maybe next time, that's why I say second out of 10, next time I will do it better. I will learn of my mistakes. And I remember when I left, there was a French lady with whom we became friends, and she is like amazing. She is trying to develop sustainability related projects in Southeast Asia. She just grabbed my hand and she was like, how was it? And I was like, oh, I forgot two lines. And she looked at me like this, what are you talking about? Because I think that was the mindset before I went to the stage. It's like, don't forget the lines. I also noticed that we had the prompts, but they were so down. So, and the camera was in front of you. It was like, it didn't look professional. And there's a few times when the guys wouldn't change the screen or they would change it too fast. And the only thing I had to do, I had to change to turn towards them and they smiled. I just smiled because like it was out of control to the point when I believed like if I wouldn't, you know, take all this emotional stress into my own hands, it would go even worse. So I smiled, I stopped, I posed. I think they thought it was like, you know, this long pose that would lead you to a bigger idea, but it wasn't like, and then yeah, I decided whatever it is, it's my story, it's my experience. Who wouldn't know it better than myself? So I started like owning the text instead of text owning me, and that changed. So eventually it was pleasure and it was joy. And I really like this few minutes after the stage. I know a lot of people would like to leave and, you know, to be on their own, but I just enjoy when people approach and they ask questions or they would like to kind of like participate in the project or they got inspired. So it's like, I think that's their few minutes and then it goes down. You take your coffee and it's like, okay, what's next to do?
You know, that's actually incredibly interesting because I've attended a lot of seminars in my time. And the thing is, you know, you're always like, should I approach the speaker after the session? I feel like he's probably just wants to go home or go to his hotel and rest, you know? So like, I've never seen or heard the perspective from the speaker about, you know, what do you expect from the audience? Should they just get up and leave or should they come talk to you and ask more questions, like you said?
It's because it's most of the times it's like, you know, usually when the room is darker and you can see a few faces that would be empathetic or they would interact with you. So like we suggest that like in their storytelling and speaking practices, you work with a few, right, who respond back. So you kind of like keep on the track. But when you don't see anything, it's like just white light in your eyes and you just deliver it and you're like, you do feel excited. So I guess by at least somebody coming over, it makes sense. It feels like there are people, there were people, and that you kind of like send the message and it was kind of like, yeah, it came across. So in that, I think those who don't want to communicate, as far as I noticed, they just leave straight away. So you can see by the body language, and those who are like, here I am, feel free to approach. And yeah, it's interesting how many interesting conversations, friendships, and collaboration that talk launched and started, which I didn't expect. That wasn't the main reason, actually, to go there. Yeah. But now I think maybe TED Talk is a good networking experience, to be honest, for the future.
Absolutely. I mean, I would personally like to have my own TED Talk, but I just have, you know, I always talk about the same thing. So there's nothing that I don't do myself anyways. But I wanted to kind of shift into the sustainability of clothing and consumerism that you've been working on. And maybe you can give us kind of like an overview and then we can go into more details.
Actually, as part of my TED Talk, I said it always starts with trauma. And I think my obsession with trash and working in sustainable field, it has something to do with the childhood experiences when, you know, like being born and raised in Soviet Union, you might have had access to as much as little and as little as possible to find. So I think people were creative against their own will. And it was like a time for me when I would be allowed to repurpose everything I find in the house. That was my mom's rule. She said, like, I wouldn't buy you stuff. But you can do so. I did my prom dress from the curtains. I still have a dress with me here that was made from the beddings. I used the upholstery from the couch for my trousers. And I've been playing around. So I guess, when did I start? Like, I started making garments at the age of 6. That's another sad story. I didn't have a Barbie, and in order to trade the Barbie from my classmates, I would offer them to make garments so they will give me the dolls to play around with. So eventually it would be them actually lining up to give me the doll, and I would be like knitting and crocheting for them jackets. So I had a lot of Barbie at that point. So I guess like playing with the Barbie that way, and I was like, if I can make it for the doll, why can't I make it for myself? I'm not sure if I approached myself as a doll for a long time, but my wardrobe was more like a costume based. I would say that I wasn't sustainable to the point of consumerism. I think I had a lot of one time to wear dresses. because I can make them, right? Like, I was as fast as to produce 3 skirts a day. It's like, if you can be as fast and efficient, repurposing all your neighbor's garments, all your relatives' garments, like, people knew that I'm recycling and upcycling. And it's like, it was more for the idea of further developing the design rather than making garments. Like, I've never had a plain dress or plain skirt. It would be always something weird and difficult for my family to understand or let me leave the house being dressed that way, so I would negotiate a lot. And it wasn't always the length, it's like the weirdness of it. Because I think back then we were still living in quite very traditional environment, I would say. I was born in Kazakhstan, so I guess there was like something from the Soviet Union where you're not supposed to be expressive, you're not supposed to be different, like it's all the same. Everybody were wearing the same dresses. People were having the same furniture in the houses. So I never understood, like I've never put two together. Why, when I started my career, I was only hired to repurpose old collections, revisited textiles from the stock. It's like, I was like, why nobody gives me a piece of fabric to create? Yeah. And I think because part of my portfolio actually resonated with them. It wasn't sustainable back then when I started. Like, I started making my own garments at the age of 12. At the age of 12, I already made myself a coat with a silver lining. Age 16, I participated in my first fashion show with, like, proper prêt-à-porter collection, actually two. So when I entered the workforce, like, all my previous collections and events, they were not typical. It wasn't like everything was made from the same piece of fabric. It was like a collection that's weird. And because it's so weird, and you have to combine, like, somebody's curtains with somebody's socks, right? You kind of, like, need to find the way. So it's like, it looks in a way like a weird.
Oh, sorry, you're... sorry, Anita? Anita, your mic is...
I'm sorry,
we're having... Oh, there you go.
Yeah, that was me. Where did you lose me? Where should I start?
So you said you were, you know, repurposing socks with someone's shirt or...
Yeah, so in a way, there was not such a term coined at that point as sustainable fashion or sustainability in general, right? It's quite brand new term. I think it's 90s when it, yeah, was actually coined but used quite later. And there, I always had to explain who I am. And when you would tell people, like, what do you do? Fashion. Is it like fashion? Because for fashion, for people would be associated with like catwalks in New York, in Paris, in London, right? In Milan. They wouldn't associate something you do that nobody needs, nobody wants to wear, but you just believe if it's not this, I can't do anything. Like, I can't do simple stuff. I'm not sure what to compare it with. It's like to write text for somebody's blog, for the website, you know, to have like better reviews, or to write the poetry. So it's like it's two completely different fields, and you can't go.
I feel again. Like yours is more artistic rather than brand related.
Yes, so that was the problem, because that's not where you start your business. You start the business with the needs of the audience and the clients, right? And the materials you can resource and their production side that could, because the more complicated the piece is, the more labor you would need, labor hours slash materials. It's like, and I think in my cases, most of the pieces, they were up to 80% handmade, which is haute couture. So, but nobody would wear stuff that's repurposed stuff from old garments, no matter how they're finished. And if they look too extravagant for the environment where nobody wears anything but Gucci and Louis Vuitton, right? Because at least if people buy expensive, they buy for the sake of the logo. So I was True. In between different systems. I was kind of like pursuing fashion. I was in a wrong place at the wrong time. That what I thought for a long time. And when my first show, I failed the competition. And apparently it was Vivienne Westwood who came to Russia for the first time ever. And I wish, and they they disregard me based on, they said like, okay, this doesn't look like fashion. It's all different. It's all weird. And it's later on when I've learned about who Vivienne Westwood was, when I got into success, and then like what her style is. And I was like, that's exactly what would she like. Not like, you know, everybody was like, I think it was just everything was supposed to be dark and black and that was fashionable. So it wasn't, it was just the general fashion. It wasn't the evolution of the fashion as a texture or evolution of the process as the finishing or evolution of the shape. So I guess, yeah, wrong time, wrong place. But it helped me. It became, you know, a place for me. I think it was my therapy. So fashion helped me to make sense of reality. It made me to make sense of everything, even nowadays science. It's like, if I don't understand something, I was experiencing like there was like a concept about ordering house and the black matter and like that everything came from nothing and how can visualize a thought. I was creating a piece and then had a collaboration with an artist. She is a plastic dancer together with an amazing photographer. And we just,
did you say plastic dancer?
Yeah, it's like they move in a different way. That's okay. Like you follow the music rather than you learn how to dance.
Okay.
And so I stitch her inside of this piece that I made, which was a cocoonish, very weird shape. And she was dancing inside of it. And she came, I was crying because that was my materialization of the thought. That was the black matter. That's the beginning of the universe. The photographer girl was crying. She was like, I need this for my therapy because when I wrap myself in something, I feel more comfortable, but I want a cocoon. And the artist, the dancing girl, was crying because when she said she came out and she revealed her body, she was uncomfortable. And she moved more beautifully inside because nobody could see her, but we could see the moves, but not her. But she could see everything, herself and us. So she enjoyed it 100%. And when she was started coming out of it, she became more shy and you can see it in her movement. So I was like, I don't know what I create. Is it fashion? Is it wearable? I doubt it. Yeah, it's a good
It sounds very symbolic of coming out of a comfort zone, actually.
Yes. And with her, she had, I think, 70 or 60% of her body covered in like rush, which she started discussing at that point. She was hiding for years and being that type of a dancer, right? They just have like a beige top and the beige like trousers or maybe shorts. So her body usually would be revealed and she even stopped practicing for that reason. So the time when I approached her, she just finished the photo shoot on the same issue, like raising awareness about people with that type of skin problem. And then I came along with my cocoonish dance. And afterwards, she went back into the industry and she said, okay, I need to embrace myself. That's it. Because she moves amazingly. Yeah, you look at it, her and it was like, God exists. If he created this, he exists.
So how are you incorporating sustainability and eco-friendly kind of applications to what you're doing these days?
So it's... I got this, like, I worked in around 13, 12 countries, I don't remember. I lived in more than that. And I worked as a fashion designer in both fashion producing countries and fashion creating countries, like West and East. And I saw no matter how good the client might be, whenever they come to visit the factory, I worked at factories in like Morocco, China, Turkey, India, the factory, their workers would have shoes on, all right? Everybody would be like clean and comb their hair. It would be like this minor things. It's like literally they would like paint the grass green. And then once everybody is gone, the conditions, it's like no matter how much you would try to check if the production of your product is sustainable or ethical, you would never be seeing the truth. I was living there and working and I was seeing like hungry people sleeping to a hungry stomach because they needed to regain energy. So after the lunchtime, they could continue. I saw people in Turkey who wouldn't be allowed to go to the bathroom or drink until we finished the order. So instead of drawing, I would take like water bottle and pour, walk around and there pour water because water is the basic necessity, right? And people are deprived because we're like short on time. And those clients were from France and Germany. So we're talking about educated, civilized world, right? That kind of like can't, and it's not their problem. It's not their mistake as well. It's like it's impossible to trace down to everything. And it's like within the production line, if we're talking about from the seed up to the garment producing that ends up on their shelves in the shop, it's like 12 different stages and everything is outsourced. So if somebody is talking about sustainability in fashion, it's like a question that big time. That's why 10 years ago, I stopped consuming anything. Like I stopped buying garments, shoes 5 years ago only, because my brother looked at their collection of my heels and he was like, you told the world that you're quite ethical. I know you can make garments. But did you tell them that you have 56 pairs of heels? And I was like, oh, and it never crossed my mind that when they say fashion, shoes and accessories part of it. So yeah, guilty. And then that was 5 years ago when he pointed. Since 5 years ago, I didn't purchase any shoes, but thanks God, I have a lot. So when I realized that as a designer, I wouldn't change the industry. I think what also added to that, I went to study towards my critical fashion degree at Goldsmiths London University. I came back, I put my diploma on the top of my brother's table saying like, I quit. He was like, what do you mean you quit? You just came from one of the best design schools in the world. It's like the whole family struggled to put you through that experience. I was like, no. And that was the first, it was third year of the program that they launched to see, you know, it's like they called it fashion, but it was all about sustainability. We would do weird stuff. They would kind of like brainwash us not to go in the industry. It was 11 people first year, 7 people second year. None of us, we're all from fashion industry. We've never been back because they made you think and reflect for 1 year. What it is and how it could be revisited. So when you come back home, you don't know how you can change it, but you know for sure that you don't want to be part of it. Even if I launch my own business and I buy fabric, the way it's dyed, the way it's produced, it's not sustainable. It's not ethical. So like I wouldn't be able to find, then I need to start making my own garment or fabric. So for that reason, I, for my degree, started working with trash and later on started revisiting trash. And I realized, okay, if I want to be taken seriously, I need to get another degree and maybe to go into management. So if I'm not a designer, but I'm the manager, or if I teach executives and like, you know, sprinkle sustainability, like charms all over, and then like how many businesses I can work with. So every business would become at least a little bit sustainable and ethical. That's how I can make an impact. So that's how I piled one degree on the top of another and changed fully. Like I've never quit fashion for the sake of fashion. I tried to launch my brand. It's more of a wearable art because I slow down the processes to the point that I don't participate in catwalks as a choice, but I do exhibitions in museums. So it's like a piece becomes an art piece. An art piece is more expensive and it's handmade and it's expected, right? So that's not the way you go about your typical business. So that's not a business approach to fashion or any business, but that's still part of me. And I think it gives me a space to start the conversations in a very easy, fun way about uncomfortable. Nobody wants to be told that their choices are unethical or they're bad people or they're abusing somebody's kids or they're engaging in the slavery. In the 21st century, this amount of people that are enslaved is more than during the slavery times. So it's like when you get all this information and when your university makes you make sure that it's like part of your DNA together with like journaling and, you know, and the documenting your processes, like your life is messed up. But then you revisit the whole system. And when you revisit the whole system, you can't, it takes time, I guess, and it takes a few years of depression because you're on your own. Especially if you go back home where it's like those ideas like brand new, you sound weird, and then you say, oh, I'm a sustainable fashion designer. And people are like, what's sustainability even? And then you understand that there is no proper translation. There is no, and if there is no term for that, it means it's not part of their discussion in the environment, right? So I need it to give lectures and to give to start giving educational courses to educate people to understand what sustainability is in order to start thinking that way and then consume. So that's how I ended up in education, also against my will. Like nothing I do, I think I'm the most illogical person. I'm just like, okay, what should I do next? And it's like a little incremental step.
But it's all kind of building into one direction though. I mean, there is still kind of a direction that you're heading towards, which is effectively making an impact as big as possible from an individual.
My personal take on it, and I'm not sure if I'm now being vulnerable sharing this as a woman, I don't have my own kids. And there was a time in my life when I was not considering kids because, you know, in another 10, 20 years, they would end up in like water wars. And I didn't want my kids to die or not to see the blue sky. I was very dramatized, drama queen. Then the time passes by and the health dictates the rules, right? And then you move on with your beliefs and you're like, it's fine. Even if they die at the age of 15 because they have nothing to eat, at least they enjoy 15 years. So the time brought me to the realization that I might not ever be able to experience motherhood, which I kind of like discussed with myself and my therapist, and it's okay. But that day I woke up with this idea of... I believe that in the past we used to live like in villages, right, in tribes. And in every village, for the sake of their intercourses, nobody knew who was the father. Because if the father is killed, right, then the child might be like an orphan. But you want still another tribe members to take care of the child. So it's like that's why women would have sex with numerous men. So, and I was like realizing, if in the past all kids of the village were our kids, why nowadays all kids of the planet can't be my kids?
Oh,
so
that's actually a very nice perspective.
And it changed my whole perception of the world and how I approach it. Like nowadays, if I will see a child, not deliberately child in need, as like, let's say, those kids that I saw in India who would be sitting in like this terrible condition in embroidery, expensive sari with like golden threads, right? Literally being in a dark space with like wetness and I don't know, like some terrible stuff. But even if I meet a child on the street these days and he or she is upset, I come over and I say like, I know everything would be fine. I was told, and I leave. So I believed I would be like playing this fairy type of a role, you know, and I would encourage as many kids as possible. So I believe the same when it comes to sustainability and fashion. My biggest issue, for some reason, it's water, because it's the basic human need and how water is used in the industry, and kids. So like most of the projects that I'm interested in is reducing of the water consumption.
Waste.
Yeah, water consumption and therefore water waste, or how we could implement the proper procedures, so the water before it would be returned back to the nature is returned to its at least either a standardized form or the pure drinking standard. And the same with the kids. So I don't know, I have the soft sport
wow.
for the kids. And I guess I raised these conversations with my friends and I realized I was quite a complicated person to be around as a friend, because they would purchase something from a very well-known brands which are cheap, you know, like I think a daughter of a friend of mine spilled something over and he was afraid that the wife would be angry, so he went and bought the same t-shirt, which is like $10, and I was like, but your child is 5 and another 5-year-old produce it for your daughter, like by consuming those brands you kind of like support the kids being involved in the industry. And he said, I don't care, I don't want my wife to scream at me. So I can understand.
Is there a way that like consumers could potentially find or purchase products or identify companies that they can buy something where they're in a middle ground between something that's eco-friendly, it's sustainable, it's ethical, but also meeting their unique, I guess, character traits as well as a fashion sense?
The problem is with any sustainable product, they wouldn't survive their competition for longer than 2-3 years. So the only thing you can do, if there is a small business that claims to be sustainable, you can go and do the background check and support. So what I do recently, like yesterday, I bought myself some artisan's earrings here in Laos. And I go deliberately to the places where they would like work with locals, and they would provide some job opportunities for people from villages that otherwise have no other means for survival and stuff like that. So it's like, I don't believe we can't do that. It's 21st century. We have access to our cell phone and internet, right? We can Google, we can research. There is the movement that's called Fashion Revolution. And I'm on the Russian team, and it actually started the conversation who made my garment. So they have the annual index. And in that annual index, you can see which brand is more sustainable or less and what sustainable practices they're using. A lot of brands don't like to respond to polls like that because they're uncomfortable. A lot of brands would use the brainwashing. They would like have a separate trail with like 10 pieces, which is like, I don't know, linen, and made in a nice way and eco-friendly, but that's more for the greenwashing of the audience. So when they say you bring your old garments, we would repurpose them, it's like usually there are no way for them to repurpose that. It's the most secondhand textiles, like if we're talking about cotton, it's less of durable when it comes to its quality. When it comes to like repurposed silk or wool, they are more expensive to produce them for the second time. Sorry. And nobody wants to do that. People want to cut expenses, right, on the production and yeah, to make margins. So in sustainability, the best garment is the garment that you already own. That's the most ethical and sustainable. And so that's
just, if it starts getting some holes in it, just knit it up and keep wearing it as much as possible.
Yeah, that's the new movement. It's about mending. Sorry, not sure what's happening. Yeah, so it's about the mending techniques, and it's about revisiting, and that's exactly what I would like maybe to raise awareness around. I mean, I understand that, and it happened during my classes with the British teacher students that I teach. We had this sustainability topics. We had a few. We had plastic pollution, sustainable consumption, sustainable living, sustainable fashion. At some point, they were like, are you brainwashing us? So I was like, okay, we can change the topic. So, and
of course, there's no brainwashing. It's simply just, you know, exposing people to a different reality.
But I just, I think because I'm so passionate about it, like I can't help myself. But then when they pointed, I was like, okay, fair enough. We can discuss some trauma and struggles and fears. So we did that as well. But when we were talking about sustainability, and most of my students would say unexpectedly that they purchase stuff in secondhand shops. And I don't know a lot of people in my environment who would do that for different reasons. Class, background, cultural, right? And I can't blame people for not going for secondhand. I can't,
well,
like,
you
I,
know, in the US, these thrift shops are becoming a trend, like it's or more than a trend. A lot of people are going to them. In the UK, lots of thrift shops are popping up. They're doing really well. I think a lot of smaller markets could probably start looking into, you know, launching a couple of thrift shops, because I think that's one of the best sustainable ways of going down. I mean, if let's say you have a shirt that's beyond repair, you know, you should consider looking at a thrift shop before going to the big brands.
So I have a different outlook on that. So I talked to one of the students, and that student, without giving away the gender, was very ethical and very kind, and there was like a quite good jacket from the thrift shop, and then I think it was stained or something. I was like, oh, it's stained, and she said it's okay, I can throw it away, it's only 5 pounds. So that's the fear of it, right? You go to their cheaper place to buy, and yeah, you don't have respect for the garment, you don't have the relationship. So I am against, in a way, I would, and I don't think it's their fault. It's our generation who messed up, and the previous generation who messed up. So why should, if I have a child or you have a child, do we want our kids to go to the thrift shop from the beginning of their lives and to then later on work with a therapist because their parents couldn't afford them garments, or there was their beliefs in sustainability that I was always looking like a person, you know, who was like stealing neighbors' garments. So I'm kind of like careful with that on a lot of, because I think I would like to understand the psychology behind everybody's perception rather than just pointing that somebody is correct and somebody's not. So in that case, I know that a lot of people who are pro green approach, they might be, oh my God, this might get back to me. They might be very aggressive, right? I don't believe in it. I believe in spreading the word with the love. And that's why I do my workshops where people bring their beyond repairment garments and we tear them apart and we do different stuff and we create designer textiles. And then they attach those designer textiles, mix and match different fabrics, swap the fabrics, not the garments. And create pieces which are wearable art, has emotional connection with, they have a story. We used it in like this therapeutical way. So like there was this lady, she came to my workshop. I was given a workshop to female entrepreneurs. They were asking for a while. I had my exhibition, they came, they wanted my code. They thought it's quite expensive for a piece that was made out of trash, which I fully agree. If they think it's that way, then somebody will think it's fine and it's actually maybe underpriced. But they said, like, why wouldn't you teach us? So we arranged the workshop, 12 hours workshop, 1 week, 4 sessions, 3 hours each. They believed I would teach them the tailoring skills. When I agreed, I never thought, in my head, I'm not teaching them how to make garments. In my head, I'm teaching them how to revisit the relationship with the garments. Like what's waste, because I wanted them to bring stuff that they didn't want. And if they didn't have enough garment that they want to throw away or get rid of, they had to go and ask the husband or the child, but to ask for the permission. It's like, it's not like, you know, sometimes the wife decides that the husband's or the children's garments like are not good enough and she takes them and she throws them away secretly. Like I was like, that's not what's happening. We're being asked. Yeah,
there's a lot of emotional attachments involved and just clothing, but also in like simple household items. Like I remember I had a lamp that, you know, a family member wanted to take. And for me, that lamp was very special because I grew up with that lamp. And it's actually one that's giving me this light right now. And I'm like, no, I'm holding on to this. And they couldn't understand why I got so like protective over the lamp. And I couldn't really explain it either. All I know is that I had really good memories with this tableside lamp.
It's interesting that you mentioned it because I had a book published and it was reviewed by the Fashion Revolution in London. It was 100 Stories of Love and Attachment. I thought I was the smartest one in the universe, like always, and I would just collect the stories, decode them, understand what's the value for overall value for all people in the garment that they don't want to throw away. And when I started decoding those stories, there was one that was actually a very worn out and torn t-shirt, but the guy was living abroad for 15 years and it was his mom who mended it for him and the mom was getting older. So he was holding that t-shirt, not because it's old, not because he was wearing it sometimes when he said he would like, you know, to feel the embrace of the mother. But he was wearing it because the t-shirt had the memory of his mom's hands on it. And wow. I would not be able to create a piece to do that. So I decided if I can't create a piece like that, I should create the process within which people create the pieces like that. And the example I wanted to give about that, their workshop I had with their entrepreneurial ladies, because they were all came very successful, very beautiful, very, you know, motivation and goal driven achievers. And one of them said, like, surprise me. I've been to therapy. I've been to art classes. Nobody surprised me. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm not here to surprise, but let's see what we can do. Two days down the road, she was in tears, crying on the floor. And she made a piece which she called The Path to My Mother. Her mother passed away 10 days prior to the course. and she was creating the textile to and she put it to place here, like where her mom put the palm for the last time to remember the touch of her dead mother. And it was all emotional. And then she had pieces left and she said, I will make the same coat for my daughter. And there, and then she looked at me and she said, like, I'm not sure what has happened, but you know that I will never throw away this coat. And that what happens when people come and I take them through the process, whatever they create, I would never be able to create. But they know the story. So I just create the space within which they open up, they discuss, they question. And it's all the stuff that I used in my own practice at Goldsmith and the practice that I developed is like design, creative thinking. And I believe that the more people I could touch upon and give them the tools so they can develop their own creative language in order to heal, that was the main topic of my TED. So it's like we all have the creativity language within us, but nobody teaches it at school. They, on the contrary, could say somewhere along the lines like, oh, your drawing is terrible, right, during the art class. Or they would say, like, your singing is bad and stuff like that. So we were judged. And then we lock down and we think, like, hey, maybe I'm not good enough. But I believe that creative language is another way of, like, we have body language. We have, like, we communicate orally and stuff like that. But I think creativity is the only way for our subconscious to talk with us. Because what happens usually, I allow them to do crazy stuff. We do collaging. We do, like, you know, a lot of abstract drawing. And when they are ready, we look at it. And I was like, and now tell me what is here in this one. And people give me amazing stories. And they were like, and they understand everything. So I was like, now you take your collage and you make a code. And that's what I love the most. When they know what each line means, it's not fashion, it's not beautiful, it's not your typical, you know, what's like trendy. It's timeless because they can explain the combination, why that cut, why that amount of fabric, you know, and everything. And that's, they have a whole story about the garment they created and it becomes their superpower, it becomes their super costume. And later on, when I follow them on social media, I can see them still wearing those garments. And usually I also like the cherry on the cake would be the professional photo shoot. I will take them We have professional makeup, professional photo shoot, professional studio, professional lights. Every woman, and I love to work with your, you know, typical, ordinary, whatever, non-model woman. Every woman becomes a model in the right hands and, you know, a little bit of a right light. And when they see the results that they made the garment themselves, they never believe they can make a garment. The most interesting thing in my practice, I know that 12 hours is not enough to make a coat. So the last day, at the end of the last hour, I usually have a date because I want to rush away from the room and I leave them on the floor with pieces and beads. They know how what needs to be put together. They don't know how. And I tell them, that's none of my business. It's not a tailoring course, I told you. So what they do, they then either find a tailor, they call their mother, they go to a friend. And then when you meet them for the photo shoot, amazing stories. Like somebody didn't see the friend for 25 years. She showed up with a bottle of wine and they were stitching the whole night and laughing. Somebody would go to her mom and reconnect. And it would remind her the moments when she was 6-year-old and she had a craft class at school. And she was kind of like, so she would reconnect with her mother. And it was beautiful stories. So in a way, I always thought if I would be a mother, I would be the lazy one. Apparently nowadays, right, the least you do for your child, the better for the psychological and mental health. And I think the same here. Maybe I'm like the worst teacher you can find. I never give them 100% of satisfaction on the last day. I leave them.
Well, teaching, parenting, and you know, management have one thing in common, which is the best kind of leader or instructor or parent is more involved in coaching the child and letting them to have their free range of thought and their free range of creativity, but within guidelines.
So yeah, the guidelines, I guess that's it. You put it even better. So that's what I try to create in my current project. It's more about like, I can't be everywhere and I can't entertain 10 people at a time, right? There is not enough lifetime.
No.
So most of my projects, I try to create around the same idea, the same concept, but taking myself out of an equation. Like, how can I make a project when within the system and the structure of it, people would get the best of the results and they would go through the same processes of creativity, but without me being there.
That's incredible. By the way, we have almost, for everyone that's listening, still listening, I'm not sure. For anyone that's there, we will take questions for the next 5 minutes. In the meantime, we're just going to keep chatting, but send your message in or your question in on the comment section and we'll try to get to it. And if within 5 minutes we don't have any comments, we'll just continue and I guess put the conversation and this session to an end. But in the meantime, I have some other questions which would actually be related toward the workshop that you mentioned. So this workshop that you've created, I think, is such a beautiful concept because you get to have that deep human connection and the satisfaction of seeing someone get in touch with older memories and actual people from the past. And I think that it's such a fantastic idea to build your own career, but also really have an emotional impact on people almost everywhere you go. I think that would be and it can be applied to so many different things as well. It's not just textiles, it could be anything else.
Yeah, so textiles was the easiest medium, and I think it started there because I was just like approached and I didn't want that much to start with, but I was like, the same I apply when I teach, like the gamification of the processes and like they're playing around with concept. I think it's just part of my practice, no matter if it's students, if I'm an invited lecturer, if I'm mentoring somebody, if I'm working with businesses. So it's like, here you see, I will show you something. These are pieces of all the boxes I can find. It's like literally boxes and stuff like that. And that's always the first place where I start with any workshop of mine. I had a workshop with the students from their technical university. They were supposed to create this like a non-imaginary whatever out of this world device. And they're within like 4 hours, I think we developed a few fun concepts, but it would always go back to the stripes of paper where I would like them to ask and reflect, like in my workshops. But I think it's also partly because I didn't want people to use phones during my classes or lectures. So you either talk or you listen or you reflect or you write down or you ask a question. Like there is no, and a lot of my students and their, yeah, everybody who started with them, it's very intense, but they know it's like they're soaked in it for 1 hour and a half and then they come back to the life to take, you know, it's like reborn, take a fresh breath. And then they went back. So it's like it's very intense. It's very emotional because I think it's complicated, right? I think if you want to go beyond their current and existent, you need to do stuff in a different way. We know that. But I think you need to discover yourself first. It's like meet yourself, understand who you are. And I believe the more I work with businesses, like, everybody's mission, vision, statement on ethos or philosophy of a company, if you will scratch the surface, you will go back down to the CEO. He knows everything about it. It's because it's a personal story. I don't want to call it trauma, but there is a personal story that's initiated that. And once people understand and release that tension from the system, right? It's not that it's kind of like drives you at the background and you don't understand. You understand where it's coming from and you take it, control over it. It's like your business speeds up. You right away understand everything about your target audience because you are the target audience and we don't know better anybody but ourselves. And I guess when I did that with my students 2 years ago, but that was like a 4 months course, half through the course, they were all asking for therapy. And my boss called me. He was like, why are your students asking for therapists out of a sudden? I was like, I have no idea. I'm teaching the cultural studies and reflectology. I know what I was doing because we were discussing. And I think that's what maybe the only
thing. Yeah, it's not like you created the issues for the students. But I think what it did is it brought a lot of issues to the surface.
I think they were, because it's a gamification process, like we had the week where they were supposed to tell a story if they were an animal. So we did a meditation for 5 minutes. Then they came up with an animal, they draw the animal, and that's your Russian class. I was teaching the language. And then the whole week, they would be telling me the stories of this animal. And of course, we know that no animal is just an animal, it's ourselves, right? But it's easier to communicate stuff through their animal rather than saying, or opening up, or, yeah, publicly.
True. I think I did the virtual version of this workshop, right?
Yeah, you did. You did. You played with us the Peluga game, right? But that was the beginning. That was when we, it was one of the demo versions when we were like still checking out if we managed to take people through the process and make them. But in your case, we were developing avatars, like in case with my students. But my students were the guinea pigs to start with. And I think a lot of stuff, because I was just doing it automatically, that's what I would do for myself. And then I had a bunch of people for 4 months to entertain. The only thing I believe I created, which I'm pleased with, is the safe space. And I literally told them, I don't care what you say as long as the grammar is correct. And nobody was judged, nobody's mistakes conceptually, or nobody's marks suffered. It wasn't the content, though of course I pay attention to the content, right? And I kind of like, sometimes if somebody's too vulnerable, I can like move to another student. But I think the free speech, the safe space that apparently nowadays young people don't experience made them so vulnerable and emotional and open up. And I just realized it's so beautiful, and they're so beautiful, they're so kind. And we most of the times just brainwash them with our ideas. It's like, I've learned from them as much as they learned from me. And that was like a mutual exchange. And if somebody's idea is amazing, I will say like straight away, wow, I've never thought of it. Like, okay, write it down. I will reflect and I'll come. And you usually don't have tutors or teachers like that, right? Because everybody is trying to fight their own fears and vulnerabilities, right? And when you come into their educational space, especially when you teach kids from Oxford and Cambridge, top universities, and here you are, I was like, guys, we're here all together to enjoy. So like, the class is supposed to at least, 70-80% of the class is supposed to be filled with laughter and jokes, because that's the only way for the brain to take in the information. You want them to remember better the vocabulary or the processes. It's just like, so we are laughing, we are playing around, we think that we do weird stuff, but actually the learning process occurred to the point that after 4 months, their vocabulary was around 2,000 expressions, not words, expressions. They were fluent about any topic from philosophy, politics, to domestic abuse.
Wow.
And so I also developed how to teach the language using design and creative skills. But their game you mentioned, I'm not sure, do we have time to discuss? Do we have any questions?
I think we're running out of time, actually. Guys, if you are typing in the comment sections, I'm not receiving it. But what Anita and I can do, if you don't mind, Anita, is we can check the comment sections on both the YouTube and LinkedIn page, and we can respond later on. Anita, do you have any last words of wisdom for anyone that is interested in the realm of fashion and sustainability?
Fashion and sustainability. I think what we all need to develop is our own personality and wardrobe. So it's like getting to know who you are, defining what you like, and sticking to that. Maybe going and searching for the style you like, or the epoch, or whatever it is. And I guess whenever you have your own style, you would be beyond fashion. So for me, sustainability is slowing down. It's like be timeless. Like, and by being timeless and not consuming what's changing ever, like without, it would even, I think, speed up to the point that it's impossible to understand what's happening in the fashion realm. But by slowing down, knowing what's your style, and maybe curating your wardrobe, instead of purchasing garments, revisiting who you are. By the end of the day, if we want it or not, but from the history of the costume and still nowadays, the way we are dressed, the way we feel, the way people approach us, like there could be a story to tell. Since I decided that I was sick and ill for so many years, 7.5, and totally my life hospitalized. And when recently I was like, every day is a miracle. Every day is an amazing opportunity to start everything again. And why not to celebrate it? And I think if we would approach it as a celebration of our life, of ourselves, like this small speck right on the rock rotating around the solar system. It's like in the universe. It's like it's such a great chance to be alive. It's such a miracle to be alive. And not taking it, I don't know, for me it's just celebration of life. And it has nothing to do with fashion. It has nothing to do with impress other people. I think it comes as a benefit. Because yesterday I was stopped on the streets and complimented by 3 women, which I take as the highest level of compliment. Like from men, it's fine. But from women, oh my God. And yeah, so it's like if you decide to celebrate yourself and your life and curate your wardrobe, slow down, stick with the garments you have, revisit them, mend them if they have holes, and eventually, if they're beyond repairs, you mentioned, come to my workshops and let's create like emotional text together. So there would be a story and there would be maybe a piece to afterwards for your kids to inherit. Like we don't approach garment this way. And they used to be approached that way in the past, right? When there would be a lot of handcraft and like stones work and embroidery and stuff like that. So garments used to be very expensive and cherished, and especially dyed fabrics, and nowadays everything is taken for granted, so we just generate waste, and then the quality of the next garments to come would be always worth
100%. And people can reach you if they want to look into the workshop that you have at anitagray.com, right?
Yeah, that's it, that's the website.
All right, excellent. Thank you so much, Anita, and thank you everyone for listening. Stay tuned for the launch of this episode on Spotify, Amazon, and Apple.
Thank you.